To talk about this, I think, gives me an excuse to talk about some issues that we are facing right now about the idea of curvature in non-commutative geometry. We are really at the beginning of long story, I think, just beginning to scratch the surface. All right, so I don't think I should say much about curvature in differential geometry, in classical geometry, classical differential geometry. We all know what they are or what it is, and how they help us in physics and mathematics. So like in classical geometry, we learn about Riemann curvature tensor. The full curvature tensor is a four tensor. And the second one, Rij, is the Ricci tensor, and last one is scalar curvature. They appear, for example, in Einstein-Hilbert action, which is the total scalar curvature, and they appear in Einstein's field equations, which is the third one, as we know. Now, the curvature, of course, is very important in topology also, because when you have a bundle or a manifold or, special case in the manifold, which is the tangent bundle case, then you can use this curvature invariance to cook up topological invariance for your space. For example, instanton numbers and topological charge are examples of this construction, which is very, very general construction in mathematics, in topology, in differential topology, called Chern-Weil theory. So the amount of curvature in a vector bundle, for example, gives you the twisting of the bundle. That's as kind of intuitively also is clear, but there's a very well-developed mechanism to relate curvature invariance to topological invariance. And these are very two different things, mind you, right? Curvature is very rigid, metric. It's very, very rigid object, but topology is soft, is homotopy invariant, but still they can feel each other. I mean, you can fit this machine with curvature, and at the end, you get something much softer, which is this topological invariance, like instanton numbers, for example, in general, Chern numbers, characteristic classes, and all that. So that's the way they appear. So that's kind of important gadget, but that's not what I want to talk about. I want to talk about what happens in non-commutative geometry. So, in 1980, actually, time is wrong. It should be 1980. Alan Kahn wrote a very influential paper, kind of beginning of non-commutative geometry. 6 pages long only, but it contains so much information. It's still worth reading again and again. One of the constructions that he does there is basically he starts with a non-commutative space, an algebra, C-star algebra, and a projective module over that space, which is like representative for a vector bundle over the space. And then he notices that this formalism of connection and curvature can be repeated in this very general non-commutative context. You can repeat that formalism. And then, like in the classical case, you have to be careful, but like in the classical case, the square of connection 4 gives you a matrix value 2 form, basically, which is the curvature form. So this exists in non-commutative geometry. He noticed that this exists. And this played a very important role in developing the theory, because once you have this sort of forms, then you can start pairing these things with traces and with cyclic co-cycles, and then you get some numbers. So these are like topological numbers. So you can actually mimic large parts of Chern-Weil theory, the construction that I was alluding to in the last page. So this formalism exists. You integrate, instead of integrating, you apply the cyclic co-cycle to your curvature form, and then you get a number. So these are these non-commutative topological numbers or Chern numbers for your non-commutative space or non-commutative bundle. In particular, this was done, he applied this construction for vector bundles over non-commutative tori, and then you do get some numbers. And for example, one of the surprises there was that, in fact, when you do this construction for non-commutative torus, Even you apply the trace to these projections, you get some bundles with non-integral rank. So any real number can appear as dimension, as rank of a vector bundle. So this was quite unusual because you have continuous dimensions in non-commutative geometry all of a sudden. You don't have necessarily only integral dimensions. You have continuous dimensions. And that's quite substantial, is a big change from the classical picture. Again, that's not what I want to talk about. So that's just I'm giving you the background that this exists. But that's not our concern. The main thing, the kind of starting point of these works is the new works really started a few years ago, just 4 years ago maybe, is to define is kind of at least the scalar curvature for spectral tuples. Now, what is a spectral tuple? Well, a spectral tuple, I'm trying to explain in the second paragraph there. So a spectral tuple is basically a non-commutative Riemannian manifold, if you want. So it's much more than just the space or topological space. You really have a structure of a Riemannian manifold. You have analog of metric in this non-commutative context. And as we know, there is this nice result in Riemannian geometry that tells you that if you have a metric, then there exists a unique compatible torsion-free connection. That's Levi-Civita connection, right? So if you have a metric, you can define the Levi-Civita connection of the metric. And then once you have the connection, we saw that how you can produce this sort of curvature invariance starting from the connection. But the thing is, the link between metrics and connections is missing in non-commutative geometry. I mean, this is kind of, in fact, it's a very interesting feature of non-commutative manifold. That's many kind of constructions in classical geometry cannot be simply mimicked. You cannot just bring those ideas to non-commutative geometry and repeat the same thing. Because, I mean, the subject otherwise would be very boring because you're just doing the same thing with non-commutative variables or maybe changing things to Q or this sort of things. You play this Q game, so to speak. It's not that. You really get new features. And one of the new features is this missing ingredients here. So how we can define a kind of curvature invariance for these spectral tuples? But I will give a very explicit example of spectral tuples very soon. That's the only thing that concerns us. So that's where we kind of things started. And in fact, that's very important for NCG, for this work. I mean, the idea, where am I? The idea is not to use classical differential geometry. So if you want to use classical differential geometry, that's a complete dead end. You get nowhere. Try to write down those formulas in non-commutative case, nothing works. What you have to do instead, you have to use ideas of spectral geometry. So this is a totally different approach to geometry and topological invariance, geometric invariance, right? So that's what we want to do. So ideas of a spectral geometry we want to adopt into the non-commutative setting. And many of those ideas actually of a spectral geometry amazingly can be imported into the non-commutative realm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's torsion free.
In other words, are both of those things? Not neither. So in other words, there's a curvature you can compute just given the connection without any knowledge of the metric. In Riemannian geometry.
This is the connection thing. If you have a connection, sure.
Is that analog now?
That has an analog, and as I was describing in my first page, yes.
Okay.
That carries over into the non-commutative setting. That's not a problem. That's been made algebraic. That's right. The question is, if you have a metric, how you can construct this sort of connection? And this whole issue of metric, you know, and then the Levi-Civita connection and all these things is very much, you know, kind of it's been discussed. So it's not completely 100% kind of finalized, I would say. So, but the big idea of non-commutative geometry, at least the metric aspects of non-commutative geometry, is a spectral geometry. I mean, we use ideas from a spectral geometry and bring it to this context. A lot of this has been shown by Kahn at actually continues to work. So what is a spectral geometry? Well, I mean, if you have like a closed Riemannian manifold, then you can construct these Laplacians on the manifold, right? So you can construct Laplacians, Laplace operator on all forms. Then these operators are very nice. If your manifold is Riemannian and closed, then they have discrete spectrum with finite multiplicity. Right? This is kind of as nice as it gets. So, for example, the way that they go to infinity actually gives you the volume of the manifold, thanks to Weyl's law, and the dimension of the manifold. This is Weyl's law from the first big result of spectral geometry is Weyl's law. That was proved by Hermann Weyl in 1911. That was in answering a question that was raised by Lorentz, by the way. Dimension and volume, both, yes. So basically, yeah, this lambda n divided by, I think, n to the power 1 over k or something, where k is the dimension of the manifold, goes to infinity, where the coefficient is exactly the volume. So both things are fixed by that. This is the Weyl's asymptotic formula. And then gradually, people extended Weyl's law. So for example, right now we know that total scalar curvature can also be computed by just knowing the spectrum. And of course, more or less by definition, we know that all these Betti numbers, topological invariants, thanks to Hodge theory, for example, we know that can be computed by just looking at the spectrum of Laplacian on p-forms, because dimension of a space of harmonic p-forms is exactly the dimension of cohomology groups, so it gives you the topology of the space. So there is a lot of information hidden in the spectrum of the manifold. That's the thing. Of course, it's not complete information. It's not isometric, complete isometric invariant. There are manifolds which are isospectral. They have exactly the same spectrum for all Laplacians, but they are not isometric. This we know since there was an example given by Milnor, I think 1963, 64, and then there's been many, many examples. It's a big industry constructing isospectral manifolds which are not isometric. However, this isospectrality still gives a lot of, spectrum gives a lot of information. And that seems to be the information that can be brought into the non-commutative world. So that's the thing that we are playing with. So the way that this information is extracted from the Laplacian is by heat trace asymptotics. So if you look at the heat equation on the manifold, well, Laplacian is the Laplacian that I introduced. If you look at the kernel of this, it has a smooth, nice kernel, k of txy. So kernel of the heat operator, exponential of minus t Laplacian. Then this has a very nice asymptotic expansion near t equal to 0. So this is the short time asymptotics as t goes to 0. There's an expansion due to, it started actually with Meenakshi-Sundaram Pleyel in 1940s, and then it was generalized by Zille to all elliptic operators. There is Zille, Dovitt, Gilkey coefficients. Schwinger even also did work on that, so his name should appear there also. So these coefficients A0, A1, A2, which gives you the value of the heat kernel on the diagonal, are completely universal coefficients, completely God-given. They just they are invariants of the metric. They depend on nothing else. They're completely well-defined invariants of the metric. And these coefficients, you can just read off this spectral invariance about manifold by computing those coefficients. But those coefficients, although there are some formulas for some of them, at least up to maybe A4 in this notation at least, or maybe A6 even, but computing them is extremely, extremely difficult. It's not easy at all to compute them. So in any example, it's a big effort to compute them. And that's what we are going after. Let me just show you some of the information that's been known to start with. So the first one is just a constant function. A0 is constant function 1. That's related to Boyle's law. The second coefficient is 1/6 of a scalar curvature. So sorry, I used the word R for a scalar curvature. I switched to S now. So this is scalar curvature. And A2, it's a mixture of three terms, which is Ricci, scalar curvature, and full Riemann scalar, full Riemann tensor appear into the picture. So that's the second coefficient.
Without boundary, no?
Sorry?
No,
without boundary,
so
that's
this
right.
This is what often are called A0, A2, A4, because all the old ones would be zero.
Zero, so exactly. Those coefficients, when there are no boundaries, when there are no singularities,
so those are the
no atoms. They are the only coefficients, the first three coefficients, that's the one, yeah. For Laplacian, exactly. That's what we have. So this we have, and then the other ones become gradually very, very complicated, and I don't need them. I just need A1 for this talk. So that's what we are. Now, the idea of a spectral triple, actually, in his talk, Fedele defined these spectral triples. I don't maybe, but I just quickly say what the spectral triple is. It's really like just an algebra which is acting by bounded operators, is represented by acting by bounded operators on Hilbert space. And then there is a Dirac operator, analog of Dirac operator. It's an abstract self-adjoint unbounded operator, but it's in many cases is analog of Dirac operator. The main thing to start with is that these commutators, commutator D and pi of A, the representation, are bounded operators. D is unbounded, but commutators are bounded. So just to have one example in mind, you can just look at any spin manifold and then, honest to God, Dirac operator for that spin manifold acting on L2 spinors is an example of, gives you an example of these spectral triples, or even smooth functions on circles, simplest case, L2 functions, and then 1 over I ddx, the partial derivative operator. These are, gives you spectral triples. So simplest type of spectral triples that are quite important. Then again, these non-commutative local invariants. So as I said, I mean, what you can do with this, if you want to study these non-commutative spaces from point of view of, you know, metric local invariants, you must assume some conditions on your spectral triple. And this existence of this kind of asymptotic expansions is most natural condition. And these conditions actually can be verified in some non-commutative examples. So this is very good. So that gets you going and then enables you to bring ideas from a spectral geometry into the game. So that condition, which is exact analog of this Zille-Dewitt asymptotic expansion, you postulate that such things exist in for your non-commutative spaces. Okay, so we can take that as a condition for your spectral triples, and then apply it to special cases. Now, the case that, as I said, this scalar curvature actually can be defined. I mean, it's not very difficult to define it using those Gilkey formulas to define a spectral triple, but computing it is real problem, is real, real challenge. So let me just show you the case that some progress, good progress actually has been made. And so this is about non-commutative two torus. So the non-commutative two torus, it's an algebra generated by two generators, U and V. You have two generators, U and V. They are unitary. And the they satisfy only one relation, VU equal to e to the 2 pi I theta UV. I mean, these relations, I think for the first time, were written by Hermann Weyl, by the way, in 1920s. He was directly inspired by Heisenberg's commutation relations. He notices that those relations don't have any bounded representations. This is the integrated form of those relations because U is e to the 2 pi ix. V is e to the 2 pi I back actually q, or the other way around. And if you write Heisenberg relation and then you integrate it, you get this sort of relation. So that's exactly the integrated form or bounded form of Heisenberg relations. So This algebra can be represented as algebra bounded operators on some Hilbert space, but it doesn't concern us right now, so I don't emphasize that. So there is this algebra which is it's called non-commutative 2 torus, and why it's called the torus at all, why the word torus is there. Well, of course, it's obviously non-commutative because VU is not equal to UV, so that's the non-commutativity. And if theta is equal to 0 or is an integer, you get indeed a commutation relation VU equal to UV, which is theta. And the claim is that that algebra for theta equal to 0 or theta an integer indeed is the algebra of continuous functions on the 2 torus. And that's not difficult to see. That's just Fourier transform. Take continuous function or smooth function on the 2 torus, write them in the Fourier mode, Fourier expansions. Then u is equal to e to the 2 pi I x, v equal to e to the 2 pi I y, and then you get that relation. And that's exactly the connection with the 2 torus. So that's why we call this as deformation of the torus, algebra of coordinates on the torus. So that's the connection with the torus. So this algebra, we have to know about this algebra is that many elements of differential geometry and analysis and integration, everything, differential calculus, basically, integration and differential calculus continues to hold and to be extended on this algebra. For example, you have analogs of partial differential operators ddx and ddy on this algebra, which is defined at the last line, or you can just define it by hand if you want. So this delta 1 is basically, this is a bad chalk. So delta 1 u, we can say, is equal to u, and delta 1 v is equal to 0, and delta 2 u is equal to 0, delta 2 v is equal to v. So this delta 1 is basically analog of 1 over I ddx, and this delta 2 is analog of 1 over I ddy. So that exists. And then also there is an algebra of subalgebra of smooth functions, which you can define. These are smooth functions, so you can define it in different ways. But eventually, these guys are nothing but Fourier series expansions with rapid growth, rapid decay. Sorry, not growth, rapid decay at infinity. That's what these Fourier series expansions of smooth functions are. So we have that. So this is the derivations that I define. And there is also an analog of integration. So this integration corresponds to this trace phi 0 that I define. And this trace is very easy to define. Actually, trace is exactly like the trace in trace of a function in Fourier expansion. What is it? It's just the constant coefficient. When you write a function in Fourier expansion, its trace is just a constant coefficient, because integral of e to the 2 pi I x and into the 2 pi I n y, even they vanish except when n is equal to 0. So except for constant functions, all these guys vanish. So there is only one term that survives, and that's the term 1. Otherwise, so traces exist, is very easy to define. Now, what we want to do, so about this torus, you have to have in mind, you can look at any kind of object, any space in mathematics from different points of view, from measure theory point of view, from topology point of view, from differential geometry, smooth point of view, from analytic point of view. So there are different hierarchies of thinking about the space as you put more and more structure, right? So the right level that we want to look at in this case is just a smoothness, or from the point of differential geometry. And for that, this is enough. But there is one aspect that we want to look at, and that's the complex geometry of these guys. So we want to define complex structures on these things. And in fact, on this non-commutative 2 torus, you can also think about some kind of elliptic curve structure on this non-commutative 2 torus. So this, sure.
So about the algebra for the non-commutative torus, right. You're saying that theta goes to 0
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
How would the algebra for just functions on the plane be different?
Oh, the algebra. Yeah, the algebra functions on the plane. It's because plane is not compact, right? So that's very unwieldy. I mean, there's no unit there, and if you want to put a unit, it means that you're looking at all bounded functions. Then the spectrum of that space is much, much bigger actually than plane. You're adding all these kind of stone check compactification, all the boundary points, which is going to be very, very strange boundary points you're adding to the space. If you want to look at functions that are dying off at infinity, right? Namely, you're looking at one-point compactification. That space is very different from this one. Then you're looking at algebra functions on the sphere, because one-point compactification of R2 is just a sphere. It's very, very different from this one. So it's totally different. Yeah. So that's why Mayal plane, for example, is different from this guy. So this is much more kind of amenable to real analysis, to good analysis. Much, much control you have here. Did I answer your question? Okay. So these complex structures or conformal structures, we don't have to think it too deeply right now about this. It's just that formally, it's like the case of elliptic curve or complex structure on the torus. You pick a point in the upper half plane, because we know that the moduli are controlled by points in the upper half plane, moduli of complex structures on the torus. And then you define these two operators, del and del bar. So del is delta 1 plus tau bar delta 2. It's a combination of these two guys. And del bar is delta 1 plus tau delta 2. It's the adjoint of this one. This H0, now the Hilbert spaces are just the completions of algebra functions on the torus. And H10 is just a space of 1-0 forms, non-commutative 1-0 forms on this space. So these things exist. You can define these things in a more conceptual way, but I don't need it right now. So I just keep it as is. So the starting point, as I said in my abstract, is a paper of Kahn and Tretkov. They wrote it a long time ago, where they looked at this conformal structure, but then they perturbed the metric. So that's the new thing. So you pick an element H, which is this kind of dilaton or this conformal factor. And this element is not a constant. It can change from point to point. It's completely changing. So it's as general as it gets. And then you perturb the volume form by this element e to the minus h. So instead of the old state, tracial state phi 0 that you had, now you have got a new state, which is phi of a equal to phi 0 e to the minus h. So you have added this extra factor to your trace. So that's like a new weight you're adding. And one effect of doing this is that phi 0 is not a trace anymore. Phi is not a trace anymore. Phi 0 was a trace, but phi is not a trace anymore. And that complicates things a lot. So the last relation that we can see over there, phi of AB equal to phi of B, boldface delta of A, it tells you how far this phi is from trace. Phi is a twisted trace in this sense exactly, in the last sense. Where this boldface delta of A is this KMS state, is this modular operator from KMS theory, from theory of von Neumann algebras. That plays a very important role in classification of von Neumann algebras way back in the early work of Kahn, actually. But for us, it's very important to fix the notation. The notation is that this boldface delta is the twisting factor that needed that tells you how much phi is away from being a trace. Trace, I mean phi of AB equal to phi of BA, and it's not, it's just this twisted. Yeah, I mean this. Yeah, that's right.
And then you
right, like Hare states for quantum groups are like that exactly. Yeah. Hare states for quantum groups are exactly KMS states in this. That's right. Yeah, right. In fact, this guy is a Hopf algebraoid.
Okay.
This guy is a Hopf algebraoid, but his kind of structure is yeah. That's right. Yeah. But that's
more yeah. meat of the
sure, sure, sure. Yeah, that connection is actually interesting, but not pursued very much. So now, finally, the spectral tuple that we want to look at, it's really just smooth functions and one forms. So this is like the Dolbeau operator that goes from functions to one forms, to one zero forms. That's the spectral tuple that we take. So the Hilbert space, so this is an even spectral tuple. So there's a chirality operator, gamma. You remember what was the notation? Gamma, the chirality. So chirality here decomposes H into two pieces, HY and H10, and these are these two pieces. And this Dirac operator D has two components, D phi and D phi star. So D phi basically is the same thing as D, so we are not, as the Dolbeau operator, we are not changing this guy. I mean, this del phi is really del going from a different Hilbert space into H10. And then you take adjoint of this guy, you go from H10 to Hy. So what is this Hy? Hy is really L2 completion of this A theta with respect to this tracial state. I mean, non-tracial state, this is the state phi. So it's L2 completion. So all these conformal perturbations of the game now has appeared in this Hy. You see, Hy is completion of A theta, not with respect to the original metric, but with respect to this perturbed metric. So that's a different Hilbert space. So although it's the same operator, but it's going from a different Hilbert space to this Hilbert space H10. So when you take its adjoint going from here to there, of course you're going to get different operator. So this del phi star is very different from del star, very, very different from del star. Now, that's how you kind of pay attention to effect of changing the volume form metric in this context. So just to emphasize, if you do this construction for ordinary torus with this conformal factor phi and that parameter tau, it really means that we have considered all metrics on the usual torus up to diffeomorphism. So we have really considered all metrics. So this is very, very general, in other words. And that's the novelty of the thing. So the work on non-commutative torus that's been done before these works, it was all concerned with flat tori, or at most tau. This is where now you have very, very general kind of metric. Curved. So this is why in some of we call them curved non-commutative tori. These are really very, very curvy non-commutative objects. So they stand the chance of having interesting curvature invariants. This doesn't make, you don't need it that much here. So the first thing that Kahn and Tretkov, Paolo Cohen, and Kahn did in the late 80s was they looked at zeta function, the spectral zeta function was this. And the interesting thing was to look at, to prove some analog of Gauss-Bonnet theorem. See, Gauss-Bonnet theorem, classically for surfaces, for example, says this, right? 1 over 2 pi integral over sigma, if you have, I don't know what notation I'm using for a scalar curvature, maybe R, or the volume of G is equal to Euler characteristic, right? This is Gauss-Bonnet theorem. For the torus, for T2, this is zero, right? So this is the statement of Gauss-Bonnet theorem. Now, using Gilkey's formulas, this implies that actually you can use those Gilkey's formula. You can show that that is equivalent to having this zeta function. Its value at 0 plus 1 is always equal to 0 for all metrics. For all metrics. Right? So this is the version of Gauss-Bonnet that you can make sense of in the non-commutative world. to start with, we didn't have any way of making sense of this gadget because we didn't have access to R, and we didn't know what to put here. But we know what to make, how to make sense of Euler characteristic of these things, because this is just a difference of dimensions of cyclic cohomology groups or K-theory groups. This side exists, this side didn't know, but this always makes sense because this is a spectral. So a statement of Gauss-Bonnet theorem is totally a spectral thing, is a completely a spectral statement. And if you can prove that, it means that you have proved the analog of Gauss-Bonnet. So that expression could not be simplified. It took many, many years to simplify that. Eventually, they simplified it, and then we generalized it for all tau. So the case that they did it was for tau equal to I. We did it for arbitrary complex conformal parameter tau. But what was missing is this expression for R. So what is R for non-commutative tori? Right? So what is R? So there are two statements. So the way that this was started was first proving Gauss-Bonnet theorem and then going deeper computing the curvature invariant itself. So as I said, the Gauss-Bonnet theorem that that was the final formula that was done for arbitrary, eventually for arbitrary complex parameter tau, an arbitrary while conformal factor e to the h or h, the Dilaton h, is that zeta of 0, the value of zeta function at 0 plus 1 is equal to 0. So after that, then of course it was clear what to do. What's the next big step? The next big step was to go and compute this R. So there is a quantity, mysterious quantity, that we didn't know what it is, but we could show that this integral is 0. Now the thing is to go and find the R itself in local forms.
I guess another question is there yes. some analog, I mean, in normal Gauss-Bonnet, the statement is you have some
Fafian.
Metric invariant, but for you,
much more complicated. You mean in higher dimensions?
No, in 2D, I was going to say, is there any analog of trying to check, you know, is there any analog of a torus with two handles?
Oh, I see. Higher genus. Higher genus surfaces. That's a very good question. There are some proposals, but not developed at all. I mean, what we understand about non-commutative tori is far, far, far better than, compared to what we understand about higher. This genus G surfaces. I don't think we have very good ideas there. That certainly, if we understand those examples, that would be a very, very interesting problem to prove Gauss-Bonnet theorem in that case. Yeah, no, we are far from really having Gauss-Bonnet theorem in that case.
But it's so like the dimension, just as the dimension doesn't have to be an integer anymore in non-commutative geometry, you're saying this.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So you're asking, for example, what if how to prove Gauss-Bonnet for arbitrary vector bundles, for example, where they have non-integral dimensions. Or how to prove, for example, Riemann-Roch in these cases. That definitely makes sense. There are some cases that's been done, but in general, it's still vastly open and it's very difficult. Right? So we have one paper on Riemann-Roch, but that's still it's not there. I mean, the general picture is completely missing. Yeah. Right. So that's okay. So then, computing curvature invariant is the main thing. So I'm explaining the proof of the Gauss-Bonnet. Sums of four terms have to be zero. Yeah, the terms have to be completely explicitly computed. It was done with the thing, so I don't want to emphasize that computation at this stage. Okay, so now how we can define curvature for a general spectral triple. So that's the thing. In two dimensions. So see, these spectral triples have this thing called metric dimension, right? So when the metric dimension is integral, so they can have non-integral metric dimensions. Actually, I don't know what to do in those cases. So maybe there is some proposal, I don't know. But when the metric dimension is integer, then for dimension 2 and for dimensions bigger than or equal to 3, we have two different definitions which take care of definition of a scalar curvature. So in dimension 2, the right definition of a scalar curvature is this first formula. Zeta A0 should be equal to phi 0 of A over R, which is more or less like this formula, right-hand side of this formula. So we are saying that if you integrate scalar curvature, basically, against some density, some arbitrary function A, right? If you integrate over this, this should always be equal to the value of zeta function at 0. But this zeta function is this spectral zeta function that's defined. This formula you can derive directly from Gilkey's formula for second term in the asymptotic expansion. The second term in the asymptotic expansion being R is exactly equivalent to this formula. Okay, so because everything is a spectral, so we can take those ideas from a spectral geometry and then, okay, that's a proposal. So that theorem over there is our definition now. So the theorems from a spectral geometry becomes your definition. And that's the first definition. If you go dimension higher, we must use different definition. We have to use residues because of gamma functions and then behave differently at different poles. So that's not. Okay, so then the game is, okay, so we have a definition of R and the game is to compute it. Now the thing is, it's rather easy to define and to justify that definition. But computing R is not easy at all. Computing R, you have to go through the whole business of pseudo-differential calculus, and it's just a lot of tricks and a lot of things. And then, because all these variables are non-commuting, there's no reason that you get a closed formula at the end of the day. There are thousands of terms, and to get any kind of closed formula is like a magic. I mean, it's not clear why we should get a closed formula at all. But you do get closed formulas. And the formula that we got up to an overall factor is, in fact, the sum of three terms for this term, scalar curvature R. So it looks like a formidable formula, but I mean, it's not so bad, actually, because if you look at it, there are like three functions, R1, R2, and W. The first function is a function of one variable. The second function is a function of two variables. And the third function, W, is also a function of two variables. What you do, you use those one variable and two variable functions to produce some operators. So the operators are obtained by evaluating those functions on that modular operator boldface nabla, right, which was related to this Tomita Takezaki theory operators. That's the part that comes from a statistical mechanics. That part comes from really a statistical mechanics. That's the KMS state. It's there exactly because, I mean, these operators are not identity operators, not trivial, exactly because this is not a trace. The guy that we deform is not a trace, is only a twisted trace. And the amount of twist is controlled by that term. So once you have those three operators, you operate, you calculate that operator, you evaluate the operator on those particular elements inside the non-commutative torus. So for example, the first one is almost like a Laplacian, delta 1 squared plus delta 2 squared, computed on h over 2, plus this cross term, you see? So the first term is almost like a Laplacian. And the last term also is nice because there is a bracket of delta 1 and delta 2. So the last term is nice. And the middle term is a bit thin, but then there is an anti-commutator appearing in the last part of the middle term.
So if you take h equal to constant, h
right,
equal to 1, you get the usual.
We get the usual curvature, exactly. And if you let theta go to 0 also, you get Gauss's formula for curvature, for the curve, for any. So if you write a metric in isothermal coordinates like e to the h, dx squared plus dy squared, as it is in this case, and there is a formula due to Gauss which gives you the curvature, is e to the minus h Laplacian of h, something like that, right? This is the standard formula, the classic formula. And this formula reproduces that formula. So yes, indeed, in different limits, it gives you known formulas, this formula.
Yeah, so this Gauss formula is probably the one that you are generalizing. The way you are probing curvature.
Exactly.
Is this with a KMS.
Exactly.
Instead of the geodesics,
yeah,
of something that,
absolutely,
you don't have.
We don't have any of that. Yeah.
From a physical.
Exactly.
Quotation mark.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This is.
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. From a spectral point of view, and yeah.
You cannot use geodesics.
No, we don't have
geodesics.
You
have equilibrium state. And you use
that's right. Yeah. Honestly, I don't understand why KMS state, equilibrium state, should appear here, but they appear here, and that's kind of interesting to understand deeply why this term is there, why this statmec term is there. Yes, and again, another thing that doesn't work in this non-commutative case is, are these formulas like Levi-Civitas formulas, for example, in general. I mean, none of that would work. Okay, but this spectral aspect worked with a lot of work and a lot of symbolic work and a lot of intriguing identities that was developed, in fact, by Alain himself for a long time. So the these functions are one, the one variable function, it's a very explicit function. It can be computed in terms of sine hyperbolic terms. So it's very nice, analytic, smooth function. This R2 is also a nice function. It's a quotient of two sine hyperbolic type functions. The amazing thing is that this is an analytic function. I mean, it's you're dividing two terms, and there are many zeros in the denominator, but they cancel. They cancel, and you really do get an analytic function everywhere. It's just there are no singularities here. That's just a nice function. That's R2, and you can compute W also quotients of very explicitly calculated functions and get that thing, W. So again, the limit as theta goes to zero, this formula reproduces the Gauss curvature. And if h is equal to zero for any tau, you get also the standard formula for curvature. So that's very reassuring, of course. But now the thing is, sometimes it looks like NCG, like a kind of guessing game. You try to bring some ideas from classical geometry and then guess what are the analogs in this case. There is no way one could guess this formula, right? The formula for this formula, there's no way you can guess it by some algebraic machinery. I mean, just extrapolating. You know, continuing, but any kind of analytic continuation, you go from this classical formula to here, there's no way one could guess that. This is completely obtained as a result of calculation. And it's important to understand why we get this type of formula. What is the combinatorics, for example, behind these things? Because, you know, you can see in the published things, we decided actually to even post some pages of calculations, the computer calculations, like 20 pages of printouts and even. It's there. I mean, it works. And so eventually, at the end of the day, these terms cancel, and you get something which you can put in a piece of paper, at least. So that's the thing. Well, after this, we decided to... okay, so this is not relevant, really. After this work, of course, the natural step is to go to higher dimensions. So you can try to go to 3 dimensions, non-contoura, you can go to 4 dimensions. So I had this dream of doing Gauss-Bonnet in 4 dimensions. And Gauss-Bonnet in 4 dimensions, of course, as you know, is much more complicated, right? Because the Gauss-Bonnet term is sums of 3 terms in 4 dimensions. And those 3 terms, you don't know what are the analogs. In this case, we have an analog of term, which is a scalar curvature in NCG because of Gilkey's formula. But there is nothing in the in Gilkey's list that would tell me that this is Gauss Bonnet. So if you go to four dimensions, you have a chance of seeing something really, really new, namely this Gauss Bonnet term in the non-commutative setting. Because we can, we know what it should be after all. You have to look at spectral zeta functions of these Laplacians on different forms. You form kind of Euler characteristic by looking at values of the things at different degrees. And if you can simplify the computation, you find an integrand over this kind of M4 manifold. And this integrand, whatever it is, it should be your non-commutative Gauss Bonnet term. And we know that it's a combination of, by the way, this Gauss Bonnet term is a combination of Riemann curvature tensor, Ricci, and a scalar, but with a different coefficients than the second Gilkey formula. It's a different mixture. So then, so I was hoping that maybe we can see what is Ricci, for example, in the non-commutative case, right? Or what is Riemann curvature tensor in the non-commutative case. There's a chance to see this sort of remnants of this kind of things. Okay, so, well, this is a very much ongoing program, but what we could do, at least in this case, was that we could compute the scalar curvature for this non-commutative 4 torus. Now, here is another issue that's important to pay attention to. The metric that we took in this case, again, is a conformal perturbation of flat metric, so like a two-dimensional case. Now, the moduli of metrics in four dimensions is much, much more complicated. It's, of course, you can, for example, you can take a diagonal one and perturb all those four entries. That would be fascinating to do. And in general, we don't know what are the moduli. So what we could do basically was kind of Poorman's general metric, as much general as we could get. That was just e to the h times the flat metric. Nevertheless, computations are quite complicated in that case. In fact, of course, it's four dimensions. It's much more complicated than two dimensions. But we could get the result, the formulas. So this machinery basically works through because you have commutation relations in four dimensions, you have these derivations, you have the trace, and you have a lot of, or you have the analog of Laplacian, a lot of things go through. But then you do get indeed, so for example, there is an analog of complex structure on T4. We have that, but then, and this conformal perturbation, so that's not very important right now. And there is a perturbed Laplacian. So you do get, in fact, a scalar curvature. Now, here is what I meant. To define a scalar curvature in four dimensions, if you use Gilkey's formula, you notice that, right-hand side is the same, but left-hand side, you have to take a residue of zeta function at s equal to 1. So that's at subleading pole. Because the leading pole, s equal to 2, is the volume. Subleading pole is the scalar curvature. So you have to compute a residue instead of computing value of zeta function. But this you know how to do. I mean, so the two definitions of a scalar curvature are different. Dimension 2, you get one definition, which is value of zeta function. For dimensions above 2, you have to compute residue of this zeta function as subleading poles, which is you know how to do, and that's the definition. Again, computing it. But so that's not very important. So this is the formula. Okay, so that's not. This is generality. So this is the formula that we got for a scalar curvature in four dimensions. In fact, looks even simpler than the two-dimensional case. In this case, the formula is. Well, one reason is that, of course, there are no cross terms because we are not using this parameter tau. Conformal parameter tau is fixed at I. So we don't have a cross term. Okay, so that's simplified thing. But I think there is reason to believe that this four-dimensional case, the way we looked at, is simpler than two dimensions because this is a very particular point in the moduli of all metrics. this conformal perturbation of flat is very, very special, very simple type of metric for four-dimensional manifold. To get really much more complicated things, you have to allow different perturbations in different directions. Then you can get perhaps a different formula. But
also the fact that conformal structure,
yeah,
in four dimensions is much simpler than in two.
That's right. It is right. It's finite
because
dimensional, right?
The conf-
exactly.
Loop, and,
exactly. In dimensions, in dimensions
so
three above.
If you go to higher,
absolutely. Yeah.
Things are slightly simpler.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's true. Dimension of the conformal group in spaces of three and above dimensions. This is a finite dimensional thing. While in two dimensions, it's infinite dimensional. I think that's related to that. So, but then again, we computed those one variable and two variable functions explicitly, and
here, the finite dimensional conformal group is the group that actually carries the Minkowski metric.
Oh,
the full local conformal invariance is still, isn't that the relevant thing here? Because
is it infinite dimensional? The local. That's infinite dimensional.
But the conformal group, the thing that's strictly speaking takes the Minkowski metric to
that it preserves, like the conformal group is the one that preserves angles.
Yeah.
And it is finite dimensional in higher dimensions. No? But the group in which you do this would be the something like the gauge group in the sense of I. Group that you make capital dilations of each point,
right,
that is infinite dimensional.
Right. So isn't that the thing that we're dealing with here? I mean, that's the, cause, I mean, cause he's considering arbitrary file transformations.
Yeah, probably is.
Yeah, we are looking at
so
arbitrary.
So the relevant thing is the fact that we are at the point, at the flat point.
Yeah, so for whatever reason, I think the formulas is not as complicated as two dimensions. So, but again, computing it is, as I said, it takes much more work than compared to two dimensions because there are many, many more terms. So this is the function, one variable function. Explicitly, we know up to many, many terms as we wanted it. And the second one is also an analytic function. You can even graph it. It's just analytic function in two variables. Okay, so we are looking at different directions. Okay, so maybe time is up, or I don't know what you're doing with time. Maybe it's up, yeah. Okay, so sure. So I'm just going to finish. And then we looked at, using this, we looked at Einstein-Hilbert action for this thing. So Einstein-Hilbert action, of course, integral of total, I mean, is total scalar curvature. Because we had the scalar curvature for this thing, we looked at the Einstein-Hilbert action, and we tried to find the extrema of this. We found the extrema in this case, actually. In that case, we found h equal to constant to be the extrema. So again, it's not a very kind of interesting extremization problem, but at least we wanted to solve it, see what we get. So using that explicit formula, so we could do it. So that's where we are right now, but there are many, many open problems. I mean, they're just beginning to, just go into this direction. Many, many open problems. And another thing is, if you go beyond non-commutative torus computations, you don't know what to do, really. I mean, it's just extremely, I mean, some tools still has to be developed. So, I mean, like pseudo-differential calculus and this thing, so still far from being completed. Yeah. So, well, thanks again. Sure.
So if you do that in 4D, I guess in Gilkey's formula, the term proportional to lambda to the zero, has, like you said, it's not just the Gauss-Bonnet term; it's a linear combination of Gauss-Bonnet and the Weyl square, tensor square.
Yeah.
But then if you, I guess you could, but then, so But then if you, I guess you could, is there a way to focus on, you know, there's this theory, in four dimensions, space is conform, there's spaces, related by a vial transform, by a local conformal transformation to the
yeah.
metric, if and only if the vial tensor vanishes.
That That's right, yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know how to calculate the Weyl tensor in NCG. I have no idea.
So is there some, but so because, no. is there some way to say
yeah.
in the normal case, in the Riemannian case,
yeah.
that there's an if and only if that it's the same as being conformally flat?
Right, but there is another. I don't know about that, but there's a way of formulating Gauss-Bonnet in terms of heat kernels again, although not directly through Gilkey things, but there is something called McKinsinger formulas. Actually, this is kind of relevant for this. So this McKinsinger says that basically, so if you look at this complex, which is like, so there is here is in a spectral triple, if you want. So a spectral triple is this. This is the operator, so H is basically Dirac sum of all differential forms, omega I, m, right? And then you complete it to get the Hilbert space. So then there is a chirality operator again here. So this is like H even, Dirac sum H odd, right? So even forms completed and odd forms. And then your Dirac D is D plus D star. So that takes you from even forms to odd forms and vice versa, right? From even to odd and vice versa. So you have that, right? So then if you compute index of this guy, this is exactly Euler characteristic. Because this is nothing but alternating sums of dimensions of this all Betti numbers, basically. This is Euler characteristic. So here is where McKinsinger formula comes and gives us this is equal to trace of basically exponential of minus t d star d. Minus trace of exponential of minus t d d star. And these terms, so you can compute using heat coefficients from the thing. So my idea was, I mean, this is something I think can be done, but it needs a lot of work. So what you have to do, because we have analogs of these forms over non-commutative tori. We have analogs of forms over non-commutative tori. We have analogs of these. And then why not going after these terms? These terms can be computed, coefficients can be computed, and at the end of the day, basically, you can write this as maybe integral of some form. And that integral, whatever it is, that's Gauss-Bonnet. Now, whether we can simplify the term or not is another thing. I don't know, but in two dimensions, we could simplify things. And that's a kind of, okay. In two dimensions, there is a cut down because of complex structure. We cut down the computations into two pieces, and just half of it was enough because we just went from H0 to H1. We didn't look at H1 to H2 because of symmetry. This is a complex structure. But in four dimensions, we cannot do that because if you do non-commutative, then this is not a Kähler manifold anymore. The four dimensions is not Kähler, so you cannot cut down. So you have to go to look at all forms. So the computations are going to be much more complicated, but essentially there is a hope. So this was my hope, and still is, to go after this term Gauss-Bonnet term without looking at Weyl tensor, without looking at, but maybe looking at Weyl curvature tensor conditions might be easy, but I mean, so that might be something, I mean, so I think it's a nice problem to see. I don't know. I mean, it's a guess. I mean, whether you can simplify those terms or not, I don't know. I mean, it'd be extremely interesting. I mean,
also, I wanted to ask about in terms of other genus in the two-dimensional case.
Right.
Is there a non-commutative two-sphere?
Right.
That's
a non-commutative two-sphere, but that thing, isn't it this zero-dimensional, that space?
It's finite dimensional. Because yeah. It's the representation of the fuzzy sphere.
Fuzzy spheres, yeah.
And it's the representation of a C2. So it can be arbitrarily large, but it's always finite dimensions. Now, it, of course, depends on the definition of dimension that we have a few, but and there are deformations of spheres, the Podel sphere, but they are finite dimensions.
Yeah, I mean, even this Podlish sphere, we work with it. I think it's just compact operators, essentially. It's algebra of compact operators. And this is basically zero dimensional. I mean, isn't it that these spectral triples on those guys they have really exponential growth rate. Exponential growth means, rate means that the space is zero dimensional. So it's not polynomial like finite dimensional spaces. So that means that you really have no chance of, you know, working with zeta functions. So it's a different.
Then there are Kohn-Landi spheres.
Right.
And they are.
Right. Those are good.
Those are very non-commutative. They are basically, you take a high four and up spheres, they have maximal tori inside of them. If the sphere is big enough, then it has tori. And then you make this tori to be non-commutative, or you deform them in a variety of ways, and they are very interesting. And in fact, the question that I wanted to ask is, instead of going up in dimensions, you could try to apply this to Kohn-Landi spheres, namely taking the maximal, the sphere has its own curvature, but then you take the maximal torus.
That's
and
right.
You deform it, and then you make it curved, and they will be really.
Yeah. They would be good
interesting
examples.
Highly non-trivial, but somehow under control.
Yeah, somehow that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Because they are spheres which are non-commutative and non-curved in a non-trivial way. Sphere is always curved, but double deformation, a geometrical and an algebraic deformation.
Right. So these Kohn-Landi spheres, they appear as isospectral deformations, right? So you have tori acting by isometries on some Riemannian manifolds. I think then, so the whole tori is inside the group of isometries of your thing.
Yes.
And you deform the Dirac operator on your manifold by this. So you form a neo-algebra. So my understanding is that this should be. Actually, I proposed this as a problem to one of my students, but I don't know what he's doing. Yes.
So just a quick comment. This Kohn-Landi construction, the algebra is somewhat deformed, but the Hilbert space and the Dirac operator is basically the classical. So you start from a classical commutative spin manifold, then you just basically deform the algebra. So I think the spectral information, whatever you're looking for.
But the algebra is non-commutative.
If you
make a non-commutative algebra, and then the action is different then. And of course, I mean, the whole thing is in the action also, the commutators, everything. So you will get, I think.
Regarding the densities, yes, I agree. I mean, these densities. For Gauss-Monnet, proving this type of identity,
the curvature forms must be interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, densities. Yeah, that's what we are interested in. Really, closed forms for curvature tensor, scalar curvature at least, I think. But then for compact quantum groups and stuff, I don't know. Can be done.
Maybe we should. Well, we can continue.
Sure.
Again.
Well, thanks a lot. Yeah.